Hi and welcome. This is Police Stories Podcast. This is episode 37. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year police career. If you've been here before, I hope you've been enjoying them. I think they're fairly varied. And if this is your first time, then welcome and hopefully you'll find this interesting. You might want to go back to the beginning possibly, depending on if you have a particular interest in a certain area. So at the moment, we're roughly following my career. And at this point, I'm a specialist firearms officer. So I've been through the sort of ARV, the armed response vehicle side of things, moved on to specialist firearms officer, which is very much more the sort of plain clothes, sneaky beaky side of it, supporting surveillance and also other sort of intelligence services. In fact, that's what we're going to talk about today. So some of the stuff that I'll talk about today at the time was very, very sensitive. I'm obviously not going to give any secrets away, particularly as the jobs that we talk about today were very highly publicised in the paper after, at the conclusion of the sort of operations that I was involved in. In fact, I was surprised at the detail that came out. But I suppose ultimately, once these things have been to court, it's very much public record, and then it becomes pretty common to see in the press and the papers, but at the time this stuff was tip top secret. There was absolutely no discussions, and you'll see that the lengths that was gone to ensure that there was no leaking of information, it was very, very tightly controlled. So a little bit like the last job we talked about, actually, in the it came out of the blue late on one night. Again, I think it was kind of, 11 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night, something like that. I wasn't particularly on call because we didn't really have that. You just kind of, there was a bit of a ring round. And if they were trying to get a team together to either assist in a job that had started and was now perhaps getting bigger, was going to require more resources. Or it might have been a pre-planned job that we knew nothing about. Just because you were on the team of maybe 30 or so SFOs, it didn't mean jobs were freely spoken about amongst yourselves, because some of them were so sensitive, that maybe only two or three people on the team or on the unit would know about it. And maybe, one of the bosses. But it doesn't mean that it's sort of freely discussed in areas. It's very much a need to know basis. And this job was one of those. So they could come as quite a surprise sometimes. And what happened was phone call about, 10 o'clock at night. Can you come in? There's a job. Now, sometimes you'd be given a little bit of flavour of that job. Oh, it's it's a siege and we need a containment. So there's going to be long term and lots of officers there and what have you. But on this one, same thing again. It was just, there's a job. Can you come in? Nothing more. And I didn't ask anymore, because if they were going to tell me more, they would have. You didn't kind of go looking for the information. You just accepted it. So off I went, about half hour driving to work. And when I got there, there was a few cars there in the car park, but not loads, not like the previous job where there'd been pretty much the whole unit and some. This was much smaller, there was maybe half a dozen cars there or so. So I was certainly intrigued, but wasn't sure what it was about. And I was working quite closely with a friend of mine. I mean, I've never really been in a scenario where you had set partners, that you stuck with for weeks, months or years. Generally, every team I'd worked on, you circulated round different partners if you were going to be double crewed. So you could be working with anyone at any time, really. It wasn't like we had set people we worked with all the time. There's pros and cons to that. It's great if you get on with them because you certainly become, you learn to work with the same person. You learn how they police, how they deal with people and kind of perhaps, their attitudes to certain things. But on the other hand, obviously, if you didn't like the person particularly, certainly when I was in the Met, and we'll come on to that very soon, you might get crewed up with the same person for maybe a 5-week stint before, it then changed. That was a long 5 weeks. If you were working with the same person that you didn't particularly get on with, or you didn't like how they policed, long 5 weeks. But in this scenario today, very much mix and match, So I came into the office, spoke to my pal who was already there and kind of said, what's going on? He said, well, it's all a bit hush hush, but it's a box job. And I kind of looked at him and was like, oh, right, seemingly knowing what he was talking about. And the conversation carried on for a bit further. And then I was like, No, I'm gonna have to stop you. Sorry. What is a box job? I have no clue. You know, I imagined it was some sort of removal job. But, you know, I thought it was quite late to get called in the office to help one of the guys, you know, move house, and we're gonna carry his boxes around for him. But I suspected it probably wasn't that, you know. So he said, "Ah, right, well, box or box 500 at the time, and I don't know if this is still a term still used, was a sort of nickname for MI5, the intelligence services. And the reason they were called that is because their old address in London was PO Box 500. So it became a box job or Box 500 or something like that. You know, that was what they were referred to. They didn't generally sort of say MI5 out loud. Now, in the UK, the intelligence services are split into two, really. You get MI5, who deal with all the kind of terrorist type threats in the homegrown area, you know, within the UK. And then MI6, which is where your James Bonds come from, is very much all about the same sort of terrorist threat, but not in this country. It's generally abroad. I'm sure, you know, they cross over sometimes, and that they work on, you know, each other's stuff, perhaps, and in conjunction, I'm sure. But yeah, MI6 generally terrorist type threats from abroad. MI5, homegrown, you know, terrorists in this country, of which unfortunately we do have a lot. You know, and it's a very wide range. You get your, you know, your right wing, your left wing. You're very specific, so that could be, you know, kind of animal liberation types. Obviously, there's an Islamist element in there, and that hasn't really gone away. It's fluctuated a bit, you know, certainly during the Gulf Wars, and you know, when Afghan was on and things like that, it was very much at its peak. Then it died off a bit, perhaps as kind of ISIS or ISIL, or depending on what you call them. I wouldn't say they were defeated, but they were certainly took a decent sort of hammer blow in reducing their operations, and they've definitely started to trickle back again now, for sure. So yeah, terrorism covers a wide area, and you know, very few people are willing to take the steps other than going online and, you know, writing on forums and things to actually physically take it further and carry out some sort of an attack. You know, that's quite a big step. It used to be, going back, you know, that people believe that terrorists had to go off, you know, to some sort of training camp 2 weeks in, you know, Syria or Iraq or Afghan or somewhere like that, and come back some sort of, you know, Gucci trained terrorist ninja, you know, who had all these skills and could make bombs out of, you know, a cigarette packet, you know, and some chewing gum and, you know, a few sort of home devices. Now, there are definitely people out there like that, but that's perhaps how it was maybe 10 years ago. Unfortunately, now and current up to current day, it's just the ideology. You know, these people have just got to convince you to take forward their ideology. No training involved, no finances. You know, the push is walk into, you know, the local store, pick up a knife and start stabbing people. You know, that's the very low level. Borrow a car, hire a car, drive it into a crowd. That's, you know, that's it. And of course, from a terrorist sort of mindset, it's fantastic for them because they don't have to spend money on you. You know, there's no training. They've just got to convince you to do it. But at the time, we were very much in the era of, you know, people that were trained and had probably been abroad to one of these, you know, terrorist training camps. And that's what this job was about. So it was a box job. It was for MI5. We were going to support them. We didn't know too many details initially. We knew we were going to the north of our ground, right on the border, to quite a large town that was made up of maybe, you know, 100,000 population, very urban, near an international airport. And our task that night was to support MI5. They were going to go and, again, this is a policey term that used to be used. I don't know if it still is, but they were going to go and lump up a car. Now, nowadays, I suspect tracking devices are put regularly on cars, and listening devices into homes and things. But at the time, lumping up a car, putting a tracker on a car, particularly if it had audio, which, you know, both police and intelligence services have got the capability of doing, you know, you're effectively eavesdropping on a conversation within a car. It's very specialist area, needs quite a high level of authority to be able to take that forward, but you can imagine gives you some fantastic evidence. So that's what we were doing basically, and we were briefed by them and also by our own guys who'd been out to recce this area. There was a particular target. And now we never knew what this was for at the time, although it became obvious later. We just literally knew they were going to go and lump up this car, and we were going to provide armed security around them while they did that. The plan was it was going to happen at 3 a.m, and that's what happened in the early hours. We went out to this location. Some of their guys went in with the device they were going to put on this car, and also they had their own sort of inner security. We were providing outer armed security, and we plotted up on the compass points around this location of this vehicle. Very quiet street at that time of the night. You know, we were always concerned that obviously they'd be seen by the occupants of the address, you know, that owned the vehicle they were looking at. But, you know, ultimately these things have to be done. And obviously going at that time of the day, you're hoping that, you know, they're going to be asleep and that you'll get away with it. So what happened was they went in, we plotted up around the location. And when they started work, before they started work, they wanted to hear on the radio a color-coded call from us. So the person, the team that was of our team that was in the sort of the north area would come up and just say on the radio, north is green. And then the next one, east is green, south is green, west is green. And that's how it would happen. And that would just continually come on the radio. We would literally just take our turns repeating. There was no gap, there was no break. They just continually had it. And that carried on for about 5 minutes, 10 minutes or so before they were then happy to approach the car. Unfortunately, when they got to the vehicle, there'd been some changes on that vehicle. There'd been some accident damage to it, which meant that the item they were going to put on that vehicle was going to become really, really obvious to the owner. So we basically had to abort the whole thing and go off. You know, very frustrating because, you know, this had taken a few hours to set up, a few hours to drive there, get the team in place and what have you. And I'm sure it's frustrating for them and us, but basically we had to come away and leave it for that night. They couldn't do it. We didn't know the full details at that point. And again, it's not the sort of thing you ask, you know, you just do what you're told. We came away and that was it. About 2 weeks later, we came back and found ourselves in exactly the same position, again, not knowing that it was going to happen. And we did the identical thing, but this time they'd made the adjustments to the device they were going to put onto that vehicle so that it, you know, wouldn't be obvious to the owners. And once again, we started, north is green, east is green, south is green, west is green, and it just continually went on the radio like that. And the person who was effectively tampering with the car, you know, needed to hear that in their ears to know that they were secure, that there was no one approaching them. And the whole thing only took about 10 minutes. And a couple of times we had east is amber. I've got two males appear drunk approaching the location. So whatever they were doing, they stopped and they either walked away or they got into a vehicle or whatever they did. I don't know what they did because we weren't sighted on them. But there was definitely a pause while these two drunks effectively walked past. And then after a period of time, the whole thing only lasted probably 20 minutes. And at least 5 or 10 minutes of that was, you know, us giving them security to start with and also to finish with. So they knew they hadn't been compromised, or at least they hoped they hadn't. Excuse me. Because obviously, you know, the proof would be in the pudding, I presume, when they started tracking that car and following it. Then, you know, they would find out whether they'd been made or not, as we would say. So that was it, really. You know, it was a bit frustrating because you didn't know what it was in relation to or what it was about or what the bigger picture was. Quite often you didn't, you know, that was just, you just did what you did. But actually, around about, I think it was about 6 months after this, same thing. We had a phone call one night, almost identical, 10 o'clock at night. Can you come in? There's a job, no details. So I thought, well, you know, I'm thinking this is probably something similar to what we've done before. And I assumed we were going to go out and, you know, lump up another car. But in actual fact, it was very different when we got there because we walked into the office and again, the car park was full. And that always gave me a little bit of a buzz because instantly you're thinking, this is good. You know, this is going to be big because the whole team is here. And that very rarely happened. But what was really unusual, and this is what I was talking about, the in-house security, when we turned up at the back door, one of the senior officers was standing on the back door of our office with a clear plastic bag. And he said, before you go into this office, before you take part in this operation, I need your mobile phone. And all phones were taken from officers and put into this bag prior to us going anywhere near this job. Excuse me. And, you know, I'd never had that happen before. So I was convinced that obviously this was a definite sneaky beaky job. So we walked into the office and then we were taken off to the sort of lecture theatre, and we received a briefing from our chief constable, which again, I'd never ever had. That was unheard of. And the briefing went that this was, some of you were involved in an operation a few months back with MI5, so, and it's another box, a box 500 job. And this is now the sort of culmination, if you like, of that job. And basically, there was six people, suspected terrorists, that were building a bomb to be arrested that night. It was in conjunction with other forces. I think in Birmingham, they were going to carry out an arrest of three. And I think we had three addresses within our area to hit as well. But obviously, they all had to happen at exactly the same time, like to the second, so that no one could ring anyone else and warn them. So in our area, we had three addresses. Our team of about 30 was split into 10 different officers. This wasn't an intervention, surprisingly. This wasn't a men in black putting indoors stun grenades, etc. Although stun grenades were discussed, and it was definitely a discussion about whether that was going to happen. But actually, there was children. There was believed to be children in the addresses. So it was decided stun grenades wouldn't be used, because not only could you absolutely terrify the children, but you actually can cause serious injury. You know, if a stun grenade, which is like a very large, loud pyrotechnic, you know, that rolls into a room, creates a huge bang, flash, you know, smoke and all the rest of it. And not just one, each individual grenade is capable of firing nine different bangs, hence them being called a nine bang. You know, if you've thrown three into the room, now my maths is not great, but that's a lot of banging and flashing. And we're not talking like a firework here, we're talking like a gunshot. You know, each one will virtually deafen you, and the flash will, you know, render you blind for a good few seconds. So can you imagine rolling that into a toddler's room? I mean, you know, you literally cause them lifelong issues, I suspect. So because children were suspected to be at the address, it was decided no to stun grenades. So my team was separated off and we were given our target address. Some of our guys had been planning this for months and we had blueprints of the home address. And basically, these guys, these terrorists, because that's what they were, had been planning this for probably, you know, a year or so. They had been to training camps. They had been away and done a series of, you know, not only training abroad, but in this country as well. And in fact, one of the national papers in the UK currently showed pictures of them up in, I think it was like the Lake District or somewhere like that, where six of them had gone away with rucksacks and stuff and were carrying out training and exercises in the sort of very rural areas of, it was either Wales or somewhere like that, you know, very, very remote areas so that they could train unnoticed. So they're very organised. And what had happened was they'd put together a very large device, a big bomb, basically, they were intending to take into central London and detonate. Now, part of that device was almost ready. It was almost ready to go. And there was some concern that had we got the timing wrong in time, in terms of when we arrest the bad guys, obviously one or more of them may have been able to take that device into London and detonate it anyway, you know, if they thought they were compromised. So what had happened was Box, MI5, had swapped out the main part of the device, the charge, the main charge, if you like, and had replaced that product that was held in a storage area in central London for kitty litter, for cat litter, because it looked very, very similar to the material that was being used in the device. So that way it looked the same, but should there be a mistake our end and they got away and intended to detonate this device, they wouldn't be able to because it was kitty litter and nothing explosive. So that was quite handy. We were told that early on. So yes, we've been separated off into our groups. We had our address to deal with, And we were once again a bit like the previous job we talked about with the tractor. You know, we were assigned individual rooms. Now, I got the bathroom again, which was a bit miffed at, you know, but somebody had to do it. And, you know, I'm not sure it was sort of my level of standing within the team. I got the bathroom. You know, I didn't get the sort of good ones, the bedroom where the guy was expected to be. I got the bathroom to clear, you know. But it was on the second floor. The plan was that I think front and back door was going to go in simultaneously. And at the same time, we were going to spike the front and back windows with Hooli bars. So there'd be a full on, again, shock and awe, smashing of glass, shouting, crashing. You know, the whole idea was we want complete sort of disruption and, you know, confusion within that house while we're getting in. They weren't necessarily believed to be armed with firearms, but that was always a possibility, which is why we were being used, and also that we had the specialist skills for carrying out those arrests in a rapid fashion, you know, and we were used to going into addresses, you know, sort of fast and aggressively, which is what it had to be. So we went out to the area and we were out there very early, kind of, I think, 1 o'clock in the morning. We were setting in place and we weren't intending to hit these addresses. So I think it was either 3 or 4 in the morning. There was a series of plain white vans had been hired. They weren't police vehicles at all. And our team of 10 were secured in the back of this van and set about 5 or 10 minutes from the location, probably an hour before we were due to go. Now, this van wasn't fitted out with anything. There wasn't seats in there. There wasn't, you know, air con. There was no windows. It was a plain panel van. And we sat on the floor in the back and we waited. Some people were carrying MP5s, long weapons. Others, depending on their role, just had handguns. And that was me. I had just my handgun on me because I was tasked to go up the stairs to the first floor, having gone through the front door. And I was heading for this bathroom to clear it. So as the time ticked away, we sat there, you know, and kind of talked amongst ourselves. We were set up at this remote, I think it was a rugby club car park. You know, we wouldn't arouse suspicion. Anyone driving past would just see, you know, a white van parked in the car park, nothing unusual there. We try and keep movement in the van to a minimum, though, because if you've got someone in the back of the van who moves around, you know, if you're walking past that van, it's instantly obvious that someone is in that van, you know, and obviously if you look in the front and see no one, you know for sure someone's in the back of that van. So we sat up and we waited. And within probably, you know, we knew that they'd already wrecked it, the guys that had this for sort of months, and they knew that our location was a 5-minute drive. This thing is, you know, worked out to the second. So 4 minutes prior to hitting the address, we drove to the address. So now 30 seconds prior to hitting that address, you can imagine at this point, the adrenaline is running a bit for us for sure. You know, we're about to go in and arrest anything up to 3 terrorists, possibly only one the address we were in, but it wasn't clear. And you just don't know what you're going to find. But we did know that there was, you know, a very large bomb that was pretty much finished, is my understanding, and ready to go. So, you know, this was, you know, we were fully intending to prevent that from happening. And this happens all the time. I have to say that people think, you know, when you hear about these things on the news or the telly, that this is a one off. But I can tell you that, you know, these operations are going on all the time. And, you know, you never hear about the ones that get prevented. You know, there's a lot of operations that are running constantly. So we pull up outside the address and the doors are cracked and, you know, we're still not running and shouting and all this. You know, we want to maintain that element of surprise as long as we can. And the guys deployed round to the back of the address. I went to the front. And then literally to the second, 4 in the morning, that first big bay window was spiked with a Hooli bar. So crash, that front window goes in. And at the split second, the back window goes in as well. The front door goes in. We used hydraulic frame spreaders to open up the frame, and then we basically just almost by hand push the door open because the locks have been rendered useless by the frame being spread so wide with the frame spreader. And now the second we're in the address, now it becomes noisy, you know, deliberately, and we're spiking the door. So we're shouting police and I'm tearing up the stairs. My gun wasn't drawn, but what had happened was I'd pulled back my jacket so that my hand was on the butt of my pistol in my pancake covert holster, which was tucked around on my right hip. The intention being that should I need to draw that, I could do it very, very quickly. So I had, as most of us did at the time, a Glock handgun with a 15 round magazine in it, Glock 17. And it very dark in the address, obviously. We had torches, and we trained a lot to shoot with torches with the handgun, you know. So I was pretty confident at that point that should a threat present itself, then I would be able to deal with it. We go up the stairs, and the bathroom, I went up the stairs. There was other officers clearing downstairs, and there was some due to come, you know, upstairs as well. But I was the first, and I'm not sure why. There was a little delay, so I was up the stairs ahead of everyone else and by myself for, you know, maybe 30 seconds, which doesn't sound long at all. But halfway up the stairs, and I could see the bathroom I was clearing in front of me, a doorway off to my right. Basically, if you went up the stairs, there was a sort of, not a mezzanine, but there was a square corridor at the top that went off to, I think it was three or four separate bedrooms. And the bedroom for the main target, we knew where he slept and, you know, where we expected him to be at that time in the morning, obviously in the bedroom. The door started to open. There was a light on within that bedroom. So as he cracked the door and opened that door slowly, you know, light flooded out into the area that I was, the top of the sort of the stairwell and the corridor, if you like, that led off to the various rooms on the upper floor. So my attention was drawn to that. I started to turn right and look. And as I did that, my brain was telling me, and I can't really explain it, but was telling me gun, because obviously adrenaline's through the roof. You know, everything is working at a million miles an hour here, eyes and ears, you're focused on everything. You're very much looking out for a threat. My brain somewhere told me that it's in a gun shape. And because of that, I started to draw my own handgun. I had it low and I held it back close into my body so that, you know, if I was going to get into a grapple with someone, it couldn't be easily taken from me. The male continued out of the door and then walked towards me. He was utterly dazed. He'd just woken up, clearly, you know, sleep in his eyes, and he's faced with lots of men running around his address, shouting, smashing of glass, etc. Excuse me, sorry, I've got a bit of a bad throat. And he walked towards me looking, yeah, completely confused and dazed, basically. But I had to act quickly and didn't want to give him any chance to do anything at all. He had nothing in his hands. Thankfully, there was enough light coming from behind. I could see that. So I was happy he wasn't a firearms threat, but I had my handgun drawn and he could see that. I basically grabbed him by the throat and pinned him against the wall off to one side, and told him who I was, because don't forget, we're in plain clothes. We had very quick sort of police ski caps that we'd put on, but in the dark and that, it may not have been obvious to him. So I pinned him by the throat, up against the wall, told him I was a police officer and just to keep still. And within, you know, 10, 20 seconds of that, I could hear my colleagues coming up the stairs behind me. And I actually carried out the arrest on that guy. And when my colleague joined me, I put my handgun away and then we turned him around and got him against the wall and he was handcuffed. I then went on to quickly clear the bathroom that I'd been originally tasked to do. But this was how, you know, you had to react. I wasn't intending to arrest him, you know, and that wasn't the plan. There was an arrest team coming up behind me that was going to get him. But obviously, I'm not just going to leave him wandering around, potentially a threat, maybe with a firearm, while I just trundle off into my bathroom because I'm tunnel vision and that's what I've got to do, clear my bathroom, you know. And in fact, what I hadn't realised was that while I got hold of him, somebody saw that I was now, you know, couldn't carry out the task I'd been given. So somebody carried on and cleared the bathroom beside me. And this was how you had to be able to do, quickly think on your feet, carry out other people's roles, know other people's roles, and then be able to switch in and carry out their role should they be either incapacitated or you know, doing something else, as I now was. So this guy was arrested and he was taken downstairs by me and out into a car. Now, when a terrorist arrest is carried out, a vehicle is very specifically prepared. The rear of the vehicle is forensically prepared and has plastic sheeting laid inside it, and the suspect is put on that plastic sheeting. Now, it's a little bit Breaking Bad in that if I open that door and show you it and you see plastic sheeting inside, you imagine it's some sort of mob hit and that we're going to kill you. And, you know, this is to sort of keep the car clean. But the reality is it's a very serious forensic scenario. There was an MI5 officer sat in the car with him in a full sort of scenes of crime suit, with one of the white suits you'd see someone walking around in. And the cuffed guy was sat next to him. Now, when they arrived, wherever they were going, and it was taken off to a central London police station, I think it was Paddington Green, because that's the designated police station to take terrorist suspects. That's common knowledge. He would have been taken off there. He got out of the vehicle. The plastic sheeting would have been removed with him, and that would have been sent off to a scenes of crime person. He would have been fully undressed and put in a suit himself. But when he was undressed, he'd have been put on a square of brown paper, and that brown paper would have been, you know, folded up and also sent off with that plastic sheeting. And the idea is, any sort of components for a bomb, for example, or any sort of forensic evidence from anything that falls off him, out of his hair, out of his eyebrows, from under his fingernails, or anything, when he's undressing, or from the back of that car, we haven't lost that evidence. So it's quite a serious scenario. So that was it. He was taken off and I never saw him again. Now, I returned to the house and I went back upstairs because I was thinking, where did this whole gun thing come from? When I went up that stairs, my brain was telling me gun. And I sort of retraced my steps and went back up the stairs, and I realised there was a massive hallway mirror off to one side of me, and that I can only think, because there was no gun, I can only think that I had seen the reflection of my own gun in that mirror, and that because it was my peripheral vision, right at the edge of my vision off to the right, my brain had just seen a gun shape. It hadn't quite computed that it was looking at me, you know, and it was my own gun. But I think that's what happened. And it might sound ridiculous to all of you, perhaps, but don't forget, you know, you can't believe the adrenaline that's going through your system, and you are looking out for a threat at that time. So it obviously took my brain and eyes a second to go, gun, there's maybe a threat. I've started to draw, or maybe I was already slightly drawn out of my holster, and that's what I've seen. Of course, I stupidly mentioned it to one of my pals later, and was then ribbed unmercilessly, as the police do with banter, for some time about how, you know, here's Dave, you know, he draws on himself if he sees himself in the mirror, you know, and all the rest of it. So, yeah, a bit of a wind up after that, which is what the police is always good for. So, yeah, successful operation. They were carried out across the country, these arrests. And ultimately, these guys all went off to court. I think there were six in total that were arrested from around the country simultaneously. The bomb was prevented in being used, which was good. All the evidence was spot on. And, yeah, they received basically full life sentences. And I don't think they'll ever come out of prison. So it was a really good job and a good one to be involved in. But yeah, so box job, box 500, yeah, something I never heard of at the time, and say may not be used anymore, but certainly at the time, that's how they were referred to. So hopefully you found that interesting. Thanks very much for listening. We'll continue on next week with something else. But until then, take it easy. Have a good week. Cheers. Bye.